Hello and welcome to another brand new episode of The Men with the Golden Tongues. I'm your host, Micah, joined by my co-host, Brad.
Yeah, baby.
And what Brad is doing there, he's making reference to the film that we are about to discuss today. Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery. Now, Brad, why did you suggest that we do this particular movie right after? So we've gone through the theatrical James Bond films, the official theatrical James Bond films.
And one unofficial one.
And one unofficial one. The only unofficial one that's worth doing, apparently. And but we wanted to keep the show going, right? We didn't want to wait for the next Bond movie and then 4 months after that so that we can, you know, pull clips and stuff. So we wanted to keep the show going. So what we're going to do now is just going to talk about spy movies and relate them to James Bond if they have some sort of relation. And
this one has a few overlaps.
Just a bit.
Just a couple.
Just a bit. They're really, really difficult to find.
So the reason that I wanted to do this first, and so Casino Royale, the Sony Casino Royale from the 60s, is a James Bond spoof movie. But I think that this is a better spoof movie. This is Austin Powers is actually my favorite spoof film of all time in any genre. And the reason why is because it is the perfect example of a spoof movie that is able to pay homage to its source material, but not necessarily be handcuffed by it. Because I think they do a good job of still telling their own story, even though that you are, it's very clearly referenced by, you know, the Connery era James Bond films unabashedly. And that's what kind of makes it different than like a Zucker Brothers film. Because like in those Zucker films, like they're spoofs as well, and they're very funny, but they're predicated on reference gags. And that's pretty much the only thing that makes them funny. They don't really tell much, like the story just kind of exists to keep the film going. But yeah, the thing that makes the movie is the gags. This movie actually does have a narrative to it, but they still are able to layer in the other stuff. And you can also tell that Mike Myers and Jay Roach have a very, you know, very huge love affair with the early Bond films, because there's so much stuff in this film that they pay, you know, pay homage to it perfectly the way, and we'll discuss it all as we go through the film. There's too many Bond references to count in this movie for sure.
I've seen all of these movies, and I enjoyed them when they came out, except for Goldmember. I really didn't care for that one too much. If I had to rate these, it would be 2, 1, 3.
Oh, you like 2 better than this?
I think I remember more of 2 than this.
That's interesting, because 2 is where it started for me. The Austin Powers films, like, you could start to see the veneer crack. I mean, they still did a good job. This, you know, obviously in Spy Who Shagged Me, they moved on to the more era Bond films that they were lampooning. I didn't think it was nearly as cohesive as this film was.
You know, I agree with that. But I do like this movie, and I was surprised when I was rewatching it. I was surprised at how well it still holds up.
With a few very notable exceptions.
Yeah.
there are a few references in this. There are a few gags in the film that were funny in 1997 when the movie released that by today's standards, like most kids or most teenagers that would watch this film wouldn't understand a couple of the gags in the film.
But I dug this movie, and it was nice revisiting it again. As you said, like there's a ton of Bond references here, from, you know, blatantly overt to slightly less overt.
and some other references as well to other genre films of that 60s era as well, that we can talk about.
So we're just going to go through the Wikipedia plot search, because I'm lazy.
Well, that's fine. But so the first reference that they make is Dr. Evil liquidating his fucking... Oh, no, that's later on in the film. This is him you have like the Spectre table at the beginning of the film. And wait, does he kill everyone at the beginning, or is it? No, he doesn't kill everyone. He does kill everyone at the beginning of the film.
He kills everyone but Mustafa and Rosa Klebb.
Frau Farbisa.
Yeah,
so he of course has the fire pit chair thingy that number one has in Thunderball.
Yes.
As you would expect an evil villain to have. So one of the reasons this that I forgot how old this film actually was, and it made me feel old, is because Will Ferrell shows up playing like a bit part, which is weird.
Yeah, he's just like, he has like one line.
Two scenes. He has two scenes in the entire movie.
Yeah, and he's playing a guy named Mustafa. So that I'm sure that wouldn't fly nowadays.
No, probably not. I do like the fact that he has like wraparound Oakleys in 1967. That's a little weird. But that leads into like the first reference, or one of the other major references in the film is they basically like rip off A Hard Day's Night during the opening credits.
Yeah,
essentially. Yeah.
I thought I had something here about this. There's a ton of trivia on this film, and I read that Mike Myers was like his dad was a big fan of 60s British comedies, so he always wanted to do one. And of course, there are a bunch of Bond references and there are other references, but like that's the original reason why he started it, because his dad liked Peter Sellers and Alec Guinness, and he wanted to play an English character in a comedy, and he was developing this, you know, English accent, and it made his wife laugh. And his wife was like, "Hey, you should write a bit, you know, write a routine based on like this English character from the 60s. And that routine, that bit, ended up being this script, which is kind of cool, man.
It's pretty cool. It's also pretty funny that this is a, like I said, it's a Bond spoof in many ways, because like the character of Austin Powers and James Bond, aside from the fact that they are undyingly loyal to England and that they will have sex with anything that moves, are like polar opposite characters in terms of their morality and their personalities.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas, you know, Austin Powers understands what date rape is. James Bond does not.
I was more referencing the fact that Austin Powers is very 60s counterculture, and Bond is the guy that thinks you should be wearing earmuffs whenever you listen to the Beatles.
Yeah, Bond is Sean Connery. I got to think that's Sean Connery just coming out.
Oh, I think that's more Ian Fleming coming out,
honestly. There you go.
more than anything else, I think that's Ian Fleming showing himself pretty much. But yeah, man, like I said, this opening title sequence is fucking wild. This movie has a lot of gags that there's a couple of gags in this film that work well the first time you see them, and then they're not as funny in subsequent watches. But stuff like this, you know, going through the sequence where all these women are chasing Austin Powers through the streets of London, and he's finding creative ways to disguise himself, including behind his own face on the cover of a Time magazine as he's sitting in like an outdoor cafe, is fucking hilarious.
It is, man. This is very 60. I mean, I wasn't alive in the 60s, but I've seen old TV shows, and this really hits the feel of it. It really hits the feel of the 60s in the beginning, and the movie does a very good job of telling a fish out of water story. He's going out, and he's at the, what is it, the Electric Psychedelic Pussycat Club?
Yeah. Like, well, this is, of course, after he gets his marching orders from probably the best named character in the history of cinema, his boss, his M, Basil Exposition, Mike Myers greets every time he pops on the screen. I'll say, "Oh, hello, Exposition." Just to let you, the audience, know what is coming at you for the next minute. It's, dude, I love that shit. See that, but that's the kind of writing I'm talking about this film that makes it excellent.
Yeah, man. Like this movie holds up, man. I was surprised. I was very surprised. So Electric Psychedelic Pussycat Club, he goes there, and I forget what his orders are exactly.
Well, his orders are to find Dr. Evil, who is I guess put out a hit on him or something like that. So
right. Dr. Evil, by the way, was originally supposed to be played by Jim Carrey.
I saw that, and I'm glad that they made the choice that they made, because I think Jim Carrey would have been way too over the top. Because I think the thing that makes Dr. Evil the best is because he's playing it super straight.
Yeah.
The entire time. Like even the scenes where Dr. Evil's being funny, he's still being serious. Like, and that's what makes it funny.
Yeah, like his backstory, his ridiculous backstory.
Oh, don't save that, because that's my absolutely that is my favorite scene in the entire movie. Is that monologue. And see, that's one of the other reasons that I think the later films in the series aren't as good, because in the later films, Dr. Evil starts to embrace the goofiness a little bit. Whereas in this movie, like I said, it's funny because he is so straight laced, and because he is like that, he's funny for the same reason that Dwight is the best character in The Office, because in his mind, he's the normal one. And it's everybody else that's weird, even though he's, you know, obviously the oddball out of everyone on the screen.
So, Austin Powers is at this club. And he they're dancing, and all of a sudden he punches a woman, and people are like, "Hey, whoa, what's up with this man? Like, why did you punch this woman?" And he's like, "Oh, well, it's not a woman, it's a man, baby." Like,
I love how much mileage they get out of that one. Like I said, that happened once in a Bond film.
Yeah,
just one time. They get a shitload of mileage out of that in this movie.
So we find out, right, it's a man, and all of a sudden Dr. Evil's there, and he tries to kill Austin Powers with a harpoon, and he starts to run away, and he hops into this chamber, right, and you can see Austin shooting at the chamber. And if you take a look at Mike Myers' face when he's shooting the gun, every time he shoots the gun, he's got his eyes closed. Because he's never, like, because Mike Myers, the actor, is not used to shooting guns in movies that he's in. So he was kind of like, the muzzle flash was just kind of like, I don't know when it's going to come out. And it's very blatant. I was like, whoa, what is this?
I'm so happy that we both have like weird, like, things that we notice, because I noticed like three things in this movie that I've never noticed in all the subsequent watches that I made, or all the previous watches that I made of it.
And this was, so I used to own this on DVD, and I used to watch director commentaries, and the director pointed that out. And I was like, oh shit. And he was like, yeah, we just liked it so much, we thought it was funny, so we just kept it in. I used to watch the heck out of this thing, man. Like, I loved it.
Oh, I had it on VHS when it first came out. I wore that thing out, man. I remember the extra scenes that they had at the end of the VHS where they, like, it was like where someone from Virchicon Human Resources called like the wife of the guard that gets run over by the steamroller. And it's like having that conversation, like notifying his next of kin that he had died. And she's like, well, what? She's like, why did he get out of the way? They're just like speeding towards him. And then they also had another one with the wife of the guy whose head got eaten off by the mutated sea bass. So. But yeah, I wore the fuck out of that VHS tape back in the day.
Oh man. So what's his name? Dr. Evil gets away. He gets away in a rocket in the shape of a Bob's Big Boy.
Now, you kids on the podcast that are listening to the podcast might not know what Bob's Big Boy is, because if you live in certain parts of the country, then those things haven't been around for 20 years. Why did they go with a Bob's Big Boy?
I have no idea.
As the rocket vessel for Dr. Evil. I never really got that.
I mean, was Bob's Big Boy a 60s staple?
It to an extent it was. It was certainly more prevalent in the 60s than it became in the 90s.
Yeah, I remember Bob's.
Oh, I do too. There was you probably remember the same one that I did. The one where the target is in Pikesville now.
Yeah, yeah.
Then it became a Shoney's.
Ah! Yeah, Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, we're both old.
Yeah, I remember Bob's Big Boy. But like I said, if you're younger than the age of like 30, there's no chance in hell that you know the fuck a Bob's Big Boy, unless you live in like this random area of the South where they still have them. Like a fucking Carl's Jr. I don't think I've ever seen a Carl's Jr.
Yeah, they're like South and West Carl's Jr. And they're not that great. So yeah, Dr. Evil gets away, and
so Austin decides to freeze himself as well.
Yeah, because why not? Like, I forget that Dr. Evil, how did Dr. Evil get frozen? Like,
his chamber that he ran off in was cryogenically frozen. So he says to Austin that I'm gonna freeze myself until a time where, you know, where people like me are free to roam the earth, and people like you are no longer around, basically.
Ah, yes, I remember now. Yeah. And Austin and Austin is like, all right, well, I'll do the same thing, man. Yeah.
So they fast forward 30 years, and I love that they got Charles Napier in this movie.
Yeah.
Who plays the same role in every film, by the way. Like he's either like the American military general, or he's a dickhead like he was in Murdoch and Rambo 2. but still always working for the government.
So they go to this cryo freezing thing, and you know, you see a bunch of sight gags, right? Like, who else is cryogenically frozen? And it's Gary Coleman and Vanilla Ice. And then we get to Austin, and Austin goes through the unfreezing process. And they, I mean, maybe I'm a child, but I love the part in the unfreezing process where I think it's step 4 or whatever, where it was like, evacuation
when he's pissing. Yeah,
when he's having his morning pee, right? Because everybody has a morning pee. Everybody has a morning pee, and this is the longest morning pee ever.
Well, he's got 30 years of pee that he has to.
Yeah, like if you sleep for 30 years, you're gonna have 30 years worth of pee.
That's how it works.
And it even does the thing where it's like you finish, and then it's like, I gotta squeeze a little more out, because it's, you know, like.
Well, the thing that makes that scene is because they keep cutting back to the three generals.
Like, God damn! All right, is he done yet?
but again, Dr. No reference there as well. So again, I can't say enough about the writing in this film. So like, when Austin, you know, wakes up finally, and he's there, and there's the, you know, Basil's there as well as Charles Napier, and then a Russian general is there as well. And so Basil introduces the Russian general, and he's like, oh, you know, a lot's changed since you've been frozen. The Cold War's over. And of course, Austin's like, oh, finally, those capitalist pigs will pay for their crimes.
This is Commander Gilmore, U.S. Strategic Command, and General Bolshevsky, Russian intelligence.
Russian intelligence? Are you mad?
A lot's happened since you were frozen. The Cold War's over.
Well, finally, those capitalist pigs will pay for their crimes, eh? Hey, comrades? Hey?
Austin, we won.
Oh, groovy, smashing. Yay, capitalism.
That's just good shit right there. And then turns on a dime, of course, when he's informed that that the West won.
So, he meets a young operative named Ms. Kensington, and I forgot to mention that this is Vanessa Kensington, her mother, played by Mimi Rogers.
Mimi Rogers, Tom Cruise's ex-wife.
Yeah, played by Mimi Rogers, aka Tom Cruise's ex-wife, was the original Mrs. Kensington, and he, you know, they were partners, and you know, he kind of had a thing for her, but you know, just things didn't work out. But
because Austin Powers respects the the bonds of marriage,
right?
unlike another character,
yeah,
that we're aware of.
I mean, Austin Powers, yeah, they're both whores, But, you know, Austin Powers is not a rapist.
He doesn't even go after people that are taken, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
I mean, shit, in Casino Royale, like, James Bond, you know, she, you know, fucking, when Eva Green's like, oh, I'm not your type, why? Am I too smart? He's like, no. He's like, no, you're single.
We, after he meets Mrs. Kensington, we get a gag scene of him getting his personal effects. And, you know, it's a bunch of 60s stuff. And then we get to the penis pump, and then there's a penis pump, and it's like, oh, it's not mine, baby. No, I don't need it. No. And then it's like, here's a receipt for a penis pump signed by Austin Powers. And it's like, oh, it's not my bag, baby. And then he has a book that says Swedish made penis enlarger pumps and me. This sort of thing is my bag. And it's just like, all right. Okay, Austin. I mean, I'll take it. It's not mine, but I'll take it. I don't know. I just like that scene.
That scene's a great scene.
I'm a bloody child.
You're not a child. You respect great writing. Well, and again, that's the thing. It's not just the writing of the film. Like the character actors in this movie are what makes these scenes happen. It's not just the lines that the clerk is saying, it's the delivery of the lines that he's saying. Because like you said, he said the scene where it's like, that sort of thing's not my bag. And then like immediately where it's like, he's like, one book, Swedish penis is all your pumps and me. This sort of thing is my bag, baby.
One Swedish made penis enlarger pump.
That's not mine.
One credit card receipt for Swedish made penis enlarger signed by Austin Powers.
I'm telling you, baby, that's not mine.
One warranty card for Swedish made penis enlarger pump filled out by Austin Powers.
I don't even know what this is. This sort of thing ain't my bag, baby.
One book, Swedish made penis enlarger pumps and me. This sort of thing is my bag, baby. By Austin Powers. Ah, just sign the form.
Like he's got that menial desk job that he hates, so the only joy he gets is to make people feel like shit.
I mean,
he's gonna embrace it.
Like you see it later too with the fucking with the soup Nazi as well. Like when the soup Nazi's dealing blackjack at the table, and Austin Powers is like, I'll sit on five. He's like, I suggest you hit, sir. Like it wouldn't be the same if you didn't have the delivery. So the supporting characters of this film deserve a hell of a lot of credit, for sure.
Yeah, because you remember all of them, right? You remember number two, you remember Scott, you remember all of them. And they're all, wow, yeah, this movie really is good, man. I totally forgot how good this movie is.
Well, and it also has like a lot of that guys as well that pop up and that you've seen in a million movies before that you might not be able to play, or TV shows as well that you might not be able to place, that all do excellent jobs.
Yeah. We get one of those groovy, like, 60s transition, you know, scenes that I used to see in stuff like Laugh-In and, you know, You Can't Do That on Television. And
again, those are good because they stay on them for, like, 2 seconds too long every single time.
Yeah, especially at the end where it's just, you see Mike Myers and his busted ass teeth. And then it cuts, you know. So it's 30 years, 1997, and Dr. Evil is there, and his cat, Mr. Bigglesworth, because, you know, this character is based off of Blofeld, who traditionally has a fluffy white cat. So Dr. Evil had a fluffy white cat, but named Mr. Bigglesworth. But Mr. Bigglesworth is had a little mishap during the unfreezing process. And now Mr. Bigglesworth is just a hairless cat. And it's just little things, right? Like you have this iconic image of Blofeld petting this, you know, beautiful white cat. And then you have this, you know, Walmart version of the character petting this weird looking you know, alien thing. It's just funny, man.
Well, and they really do go out of their way. So, like, there's this podcast that I check out called Art of the Score, where they, like, go deep dive into, like, different film scores. And they started a three-part series of James Bond this past month. And they talk about, like, in You Only Live Twice, like, if you looked at the, like, the Spectre themes in You Only Live Twice and you play them next to the, like, Dr. Evil themes in Austin Powers, like, they are remarkably similar if you, like, listen to them side by side. Like, they really were going for, like I said, especially the later 60s Bond films, really, really playing that up as much as they possibly could. And like you said, it's the little touches like this that, you know, the obvious references, but they're also hilarious at the same time.
So we meet the members of Dr. Evil's crew. Did they have a name like Spectre? I can't remember.
No, Virtucon was the name of the company, the corporate front, basically. But no, they didn't have a clever acronym.
So Robert Wagner is Dr. Evil's number two guy, and his character's name is Number Two. Mindy Sterling is Frau Farbissina, who is modeled after Rosa Klebb. Mustafa is there, played by Will Ferrell. And we are introduced to a character played by Joe Son. This character is a short, stocky Korean gentleman in a tuxedo with a bowler hat that is deadly. And his name is Random Task. And I'm sorry, man. Like, that's just amusing to me as a Bond fan, man. Like, it just is.
They even use his background similar to, like, Harold Sakata's background too, because he even mentions that he's a ex-Korean wrestler. And so, but he does. His bowler hat is not deadly. It's his shoe that is.
Yes, he takes his shoe off because obviously. he's the same but different, and the shoe he demonstrates, right, in the same fashion that Oddjob demonstrates his deadly hat. He throws the shoe at a statue, and that just happened to be in the lair, and knocks it off, and it's just a clean cut. One shoe, there's a clean cut, knocks the statue's head clean off. All right,
that's how you know.
There's also an Irish assassin there, and he's got a Pandora charm bracelet on, apparently. And he's always talking about people are trying to get his lucky charms, and Frau Farbissina is just laughing and mocking him about lucky charms commercials.
See, I feel like that's another thing that younger kids today won't like. Do they still have the Lucky Charms?
They do have Lucky Charms. Okay, they do have Lucky Charms, and all that was improvised.
Oh, really? Well, that makes sense.
All that was improvised by her, and it was just like because you can kind of feel because it's funny, but it there's no like
there's no structure to it. Yeah, there's no structure to it. It's just her kind of just like kind of free flowing with it, basically.
Yeah, just her kind of mocking him. So Number Two is set up Virtucon. Virtucon makes a ton of money, man. It makes a ton of money. And Dr. Evil is like, all right, it's down to business. It's time to threaten the world. And how does he do it? Do you remember specifically?
I do, because this is my second most favorite scene in the entire movie. It's when he's going through his plans for to ransom the world. So the first plan is to, you know, make it appear as if Prince Charles has had an affair out of wedlock, and if the royal family doesn't pay them a sum of money, then they'll release, you know, issues of the affair, and that'll lead to divorce of the royal couple. And again another scene where, like, the supporting character makes the scene because Robert Wagner just like over there is like clear as throat. Prince Charles did have an affair. Like he announced it to the world. They are now divorced.
As you know, the royal family of Britain are the wealthiest landowners in the world. Either the royal family pays us an exorbitant amount of money, or we make it seem that Prince Charles has had an affair outside of marriage and therefore would have to divorce.
Prince Charles did have an affair. He admitted it, and they are now divorced.
Right, okay, people, you have to tell me these things, all right? I've been frozen for 30 years, okay? Throw me a frickin' bone here. I'm the boss. Need the info. Okay, no problem. Here's my second plan. Back in the 60s, I developed a weather-changing machine, which was, in essence, a sophisticated heat beam, which we called a laser. Using these lasers, we punch a hole in the protective layer around the world, which we call the ozone layer. Slowly but surely, ultraviolet rays would pour in, increasing the risk of skin cancer that is, unless the world pays us a hefty ransom.
That also already has happened.
Shit. Oh, hell, let's just do what we always do. Hijack some nuclear weapons and hold the world hostage.
Oh, man. And he's like, all right, let's hold the world for ransom. And, you know, this is still a man out of time. So he's like, let's hold the world ransom for $1 million. I think that's where I subconsciously get that stuff from. Like when I pop my B's and
your M's.
Extend my M's, I think that's where I get it from subconsciously. Because that's the kind of effect that this movie has on
you. You know who else has been subconsciously getting stuff from these movies, by the way? I'm pretty sure that, because like we all remember Donald Trump in the 80s and early 90s, right? Like where he just looked like a regular dude. Like he looked like an 80s douche, right? Like that's what Donald Trump looked like. But as I was watching this film, I'm looking at Mike Myers' facial expressions during certain things when Dr. Evil is doing stuff. And I'm just like, that looks a lot like Donald Trump now. Like, I feel like Donald Trump watched the Austin Powers film and just started mimicking his facial expressions.
Oh, shit. Yeah, I see it, right? Because it's like the pouty lips, and it's like the smugness. Oh, my God, dude. Dr. Evil is running America.
I couldn't get that out of my head the entire time. Because like I said, I just like there's a hard and fast point when Donald Trump started, you know, stopped being just 80s douche Donald Trump and started being, you know, grumpy old clayface man Donald Trump. And then and it was pretty much when this film came out.
Oh shit.
So yeah.
So he wants to hold the world ransom for $1 million, and they're looking, and he's like, Virgicon makes
$9 billion a year alone.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, and they were actually, oh, that's pretty good. That's a lot. I like that when he finally settles on $100 billion, like he keeps looking it over at number two just to make sure that he's not gonna get shot down as he's saying it. So
oh man. I can't remember if this was where Seth Green is introduced. I don't.
It is. It is where Seth Green. It's also where Mustafa meets his end, quite painfully, and again an extended portion of time because he tips him backwards, and he goes into the fire pit, but it doesn't kill him. He's just very badly burned, and you keep hearing him like cry for help through the grate of the floor. And then he gets shot, and then he just sits there and remarks that the guy shot him in the arm. And then he shoots him again, and like, you see just like Dr. was just like waiting. Right.
So Dr. Evil is trying to bond with his son, played by Seth Green, and he's just not doing it, right? He's like, I'm down with the kids. And he's doing like this weird Frankenstein Macarena. It's just odd.
And, and again, for you younger listeners, the Macarena was a hugely popular dance in 1996. And it didn't last long beyond 1996. Like, it lasted for that summer. It was the Despacito of its day.
So, kids don't know what the Macarena
is. No, they have no clue.
Wow. God damn.
We're old, Micah. There's an AOL joke later in the film.
Yeah. He did. The director did that AOL joke. He put that product placement in there because they agreed to give him a year's worth of free.
Don't he not have enough CDs at home already? He didn't have enough free 2,000 hour CDs or whatever they were.
Jesus Christ, America Online. So we cut back to Austin and Vanessa, and they're going to investigate Dr. Evil, right? So they go to this hotel in Vegas and they plan to pose as a married couple. And so they're in the thing, right? They're in the hotel room and they're unpacking, right? And Austin takes out his Walther, the same Walther that James Bond uses. And the gun is not a big gun, right? Like, it is a sleek pistol that you can conceal, right? And Austin looks at it and he kisses it. Mwah! And then all of a sudden, Vanessa pulls out a goddamn Desert Eagle. A goddamn 50 caliber handgun. And you see Austin get just a little bit of penis envy. And they don't linger on it, but you see it. It's long enough that you see it, and it's just like, oh okay.
her gun says Desert Eagle 0.50 on the side.
That's another one of my favorite movies.
I love that movie. I wish we could do it on this podcast. I don't think we should because it doesn't really have anything to do with it. But
you know what? It's our podcast. We can do whatever the fuck we want.
Yeah, we'll maybe later on. Maybe later on.
So yeah, we go down and we get a scene similar to, you know, the scenes in Bond films where it's Bond and he's in some sort of gaming arena and he's playing cards, right? And this is the blackjack scene. So number two is there. He looks like he's looking like Largo with his white tuxedo jacket and eye patch, and the soup Nazi starts dealing cards, and I think he had like number two had like a 17, and he was like, "I'll hit." And the soup Nazi's like, "You sure you want to do that?" He was like, "Yeah, I like to live dangerously."
Well, he has a special eye patch that lets him see what the next card is. So he knew that he was gonna draw a four.
Right. So he draws a four, right? And he's like, "Wow, that's awesome." And then, like you said earlier, Austin has a two and a three. He's just like, "I'll stand." He's like, "Are you sure?"
I suggest you hit, sir.
I also like to live dangerously. What? And then I forget what he gets.
Well, that's it. That's all. He stands on five, and the dealer's like, "All right, dealer has 20. You lose."
Five. I'll stay. I suggest you hit, sir.
I also like to live dangerously.
As you wish, sir. 20 beats your 5. I'm sorry, sir.
Because the dealer was showing a face card, by the way, too, which is...
Right, yeah. He was showing a... God damn it. So, number two goes into...
First, we're introduced to his assistant that he has with him at the table.
How could I forget?
How could you forget?
Yes, thank you. His assistant is an Italian woman. whose name is Alada Vagina. Alada Vagina.
I mean, look, after Pussy Galore, it's a miracle that we didn't get a Bond girl name as overt as Alada Vagina. So overt that Austin Powers even is taken aback by it.
Yeah. And look, man, it's not even like, it's like, I kind of would have preferred Alada Vagina. Like, that's more of a, I believe that name more than Pussy Galore.
to be fair, I feel like that, even though that was her name in the book as well, I feel like that name is almost just worth that one, the line that he has when he first meets her in Goldfinger.
Yeah. I mean, that is the quintessential, you know, naming a character for a joke. You know, like that, naming a character just so you can have Bond say that line. You know what I mean? Like, there's no other reason why her name should be Pussy Galore. But a lot of vagina is censored on, like, when they rebroadcast this over like TNT or whatever.
Oh, really? Well, yeah, I guess that makes sense.
They censor it to a lot of cleavage.
That's not good, though.
That's not good at all.
No, that's no good.
No, that's not good.
You might as well just not have him be introduced to the character at that point.
Right. Right. So, number two goes out. He walks away. Austin's trying to track him. Austin goes into this bathroom, right? And where he meets Cowboy Tom Arnold. And it's Tom Arnold, as in former Mr. Roseanne Barr, Tom Arnold.
I feel so, here's one of the great mysteries of the 90s. How didn't Tom Arnold parlay his excellent turn in True Lies into a more successful film career?
Yeah, I did enjoy him in True Lies.
Is that a movie that will likely be done on this very podcast at some point?
Yeah, absolutely. So he goes in the bathroom and he strikes up a conversation with Tom Arnold's cowboy, you know, JBL-esque.
I do love how, again, when you say Tom Arnold cowboy, like, Tom Arnold is in the full-fledged, like, I'm a dickhead from Texas.
Yeah,
get up, like the full, like, jacket, pants, 10-gallon hat, you know, all that other bullshit. Like, and his reaction to Austin Powers, who also, of course, is in the crushed velvet, you know, suit. That's quite a crazy get-up you got there. With no sense of irony whatsoever. And then the other great line, he's like, what are you, part of the show? And he's like, actually, I'm British. And he's like, oh, sorry about that.
So the whole point of this scene is to make a shit joke.
Yeah, this one is a little, again, I'm sure I thought this was funnier when I was 14.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I'm like, all right. But now that I'm grown, it's like, all right, guys. Like, literally the only point of the scene is to make a shit joke. And so Austin is on the toilet and the Irish assassin comes in and tries to use his Lucky Charms chain as a garrote wire. And there's a struggle and he's in the stall and, you know, Tom Arnold, the cowboy, is in the stall next to him and he's struggling and he's like, whoa, buddy, you know, give a courtesy flush. You can't force it, man. You just got to let it happen naturally. And Austin at one point is like, who does number two work for? You know, he's interrogating the assassin trying to kill him. And then Tom Arnold says, yeah, you show that turd who's boss. And it's just a shit joke. It got a laugh out of me 30 years ago or 20 years ago, but not so much this time.
But again, I think that's more Tom Arnold's fault. If you'd had a better character in the other stall, maybe it would have been a little bit better. I would have almost preferred someone that was just like silent, like just reacting to it.
Yeah, just reacting.
Yeah.
I think just reacting and then at the end of it say something funny, you know what I mean?
So the next scene is when like Dr. Evil calls the UN Security Council.
Yo, now, this is the UN by way of Capcom.
Like, I'm just saying, like, so the UN by way of Capcom, I'm sure that it was for budgetary reasons, but why is the UN Security Council meeting in like an all black chamber around a very villainous looking table, essentially?
Yeah.
So that's number one. Number two, did they get all the Seinfeld actors, or did Seinfeld just happen to get all the actors and they just happen to be in it? Because you have fucking Babu is in this. We just saw the soup Nazi. We're going to see the wig master later on in the film. So that was a little weird.
Seinfeld was breaking people's careers for them.
I guess it was. And the one thing I've never noticed before, but the guy behind Babu's character had like the Gorbachev birthmark on his head.
Oh, he did.
I never seen that before. Yeah, I never noticed that. I, for some reason, this latest time, I noticed it for the first time.
this UN council meeting is ridiculous. I'm assuming this is the Japanese UN member who is a sumo wrestler. There is a dude in bagpipes. There is a Mountie back there.
Is it the Mountie?
There's a black dude in a dashiki. There is a matador. There is a cowboy. Like, it's just, there's a Hasidic Jew, a Jewish man. It is just, it's a racial stereotype heaven. And I love it because I think racial stereotypes are funny. and then they do something that I think is just genius to me. The villains are proud of themselves, and they're explaining to us, the audience, what they're doing without explaining it to us. They're talking amongst themselves. And then they are so satisfied with what they're doing that they start their evil laugh. And in any other movie, the evil laugh would be cut in mid laugh, right? But they're like, what would happen after the evil laugh? And this shit is fucking genius. It's the first and only time I've seen a movie do this, where they're just like, we're completely satisfied. All right. I don't know, man. I thought it was genius.
You are correct. It is genius.
We cut to a conversation between Mama Kensington and Daughter Kensington. And they're talking about Austin. And what they're doing here is they're doing camera tricks with nudity.
Now, see, this is the what would be the series problem in later films, is where they have a funny bit, mm-hmm. and instead of just letting the funny bit lie, they want to go back to the well too often. Mm-hmm. Like, cause they would do the same gag later in the film, and then they would do it in the second film as well. And then they would do it in the third film as well. And it's just like, you kind of beat a dead horse in the ground at mm-hmm. that point. Like, it would have been funnier if they did it the one time and then didn't go back to it.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Or, you know, if you do it twice, like normally people do comedy in threes, you know, the first time you do it, it's funny. The second time it's like, all right, well, we just saw that. And then the third time it's funny again for some strange reason, like it just kind of is. The camera tricks were, I think this first scene with the nudity camera tricks is great. When they go back to it in this movie, it doesn't.
More because the second time it's way more ham-fisted than it is.
Yeah, to the point where it's even like, hey, here's a pair of bare breasts over top of her bare breasts.
Right.
Okay, like at least, you know, with the cassava melons, you know, it was, you know, a joke. But no, this is what we're trying to do, folks. We're trying to show that this is fucking titty. And the next couple scenes, our montage, getting to know you montage, and Burt Bacharach is in it, and
let me ask you a question: as any like Burt Bacharach like was an established musician for, you know, throughout the 60s and 70s, but I have to imagine his career, went into some sort of a small renaissance after this film.
I would have to think so.
Well, right? they brought him back for the second one too.
Yeah, I would have to think so. God, he's still alive, man.
I know. Yes, I know. Burt Bacharach is still alive. I don't know what the fuck he's doing. I'm assuming he's still playing music.
I hope so. God damn. Dude's 90, man. All right. You figured everybody from the swinging 60s would have some sort of, I don't know. So more getting to know you stuff. They're playing Twister, and Austin is being cute. And Vanessa is drunk off her ass, and Austin is being funny and being a good dude, and Vanessa is like, I want to jump them bones, and Austin's like, nah, you're smashed, man, I can't, it's not right, I can't take advantage of you like this, proving that this ridiculous ass character is a good dude, unlike the guy he's based off of.
Well, and it goes like the next step further is when he's, she's like, tell me about my mom in the 60s, and he's like, he's very sorrowful that he obviously loved her mom very much, but because she was married, like he can never have her. That's one of the huge regrets from his life, I guess.
Yeah, whereas James Bond would have fucking killed the guy.
Or he would just fuck her anyway.
Yeah, fuck it. Can't waste a bullet. I'll just fuck you in. So she passes out, and exposition comes calling, and Austin opens up this laptop that looks like it's something out of a IKEA display case. It's just the ugliest thing I've ever seen. And exposition comes in and he does his job. He has to get the story moving, So it's like, hey, go to a lot of vaginas penthouse and find the secret plans or whatever. So he goes there he finds the plans or whatever, and a lot of vagina comes home, and Austin and they essentially seduce each other, and they get into a hot tub, and the way Austin gets into this hot tub, first of all, he's got to take off all this shit, right? And he's got to take off his crushed velvet suit and the pirate shirt, and he gets
to wear a pirate shirt.
He gets into the hot tub, and the way he gets into the hot tub always tickled me. He gets into the hot tub and he covers his nipples. And then it's just like, okay. It's just the most corny way to get into a hot tub. But then he's just like, yeah, I'm the man.
And then he gets to sleep with the Italian chick.
Yeah. Then he gets a lot of vagina.
But of course, she digs into his pants pocket and finds the business card that he carries with him for some reason. that showing that he is an international man of mystery.
I mean, is that any different from James Bond just saying, "Yeah, I'm James Bond"? You know what I mean? Like especially in what was that, Casino Royale, where Eva Green was her character was like, "Oh, we're posing as." Mr. and Mrs. Terwilliger or whatever, right? And James Bond is just like, no, that name is dumb. I'm James Bond. Who is this for? I'm James Bond. It's under Terwilliger or whatever. Just like, fuck you.
It's at least as dumb as in Diamonds Are Forever when James Bond is carrying around his Players Club card in his wallet, which he then plants on a dead body to make, Tiffany Case thinks that is James Bond. It's a fucking sharper image credit card.
Next scene, we get introduced to the Fembots. And the Fembots are sexy 60s ladies that are robots with machine gun boobs. And there you go.
I mean, that is an effective weapon against Austin Powers. I can agree.
Yeah. You have to appeal to, you know, the your adversary's weakness. And apparently it's the ladies.
Cindy Margolis was one of those Fembots too, by the way.
Oh, she was?
Yeah.
Oh.
You go through the casting list.
I didn't notice that. So we cut to a scene of this is always funny for me. Like, this is the Q scene, right? I always love the Q scenes in James Bond movies, and this is the Q scene. And so Vanessa's like, hey, here's this fancy. Well, first of all, it's called British makeshift headquarters. And he's like, hey, here's this fancy watch. And it does all this cool shit, right? And then she's like, and here we have this. And it is product placement for dental, you know, dental supplies, right? Like, it's Scope mouthwash, Johnson & Johnson floss, and Crest toothpaste. And Austin is like, oh, wait, let me guess. The floss is garrote wire. The toothpaste is explosives, and the mouthwash is acid. And she's like, nah, it's just toothpaste and mouthwash and floss. Because you got to do something about them. Then she's like, there have been many, many advances in dental technology since you've been in, since you've awakened. He's just like, what? Huh?
When did the stereotype of British people having terrible teeth go away? I feel like it did. I don't really hear people talk about it anymore because The Simpsons perpetrated it for a while.
Yeah, they did.
You remember the big book of British smiles that the dentist used to scare Lisa into wearing braces?
Yeah. Keeping the tradition alive of making Simpsons references on this show. Yeah, I think they did a tooth joke in the second one, but it was like,
well, the second one, because at the end of the film he gets his teeth fixed, and then somehow when he travels back in time, his teeth get fucked up again.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just thinking about some of the jokes from the second one, and they're a little more crass.
They're more on the nose. Like I said, the subtlety and the writing, I don't think, is there as much.
When Basil Exposition comes up after Austin, you know, is told that his teeth are jacked up, you know, a little character moment of him being insecure, and it's just like, he smiles with his mouth closed. Like it's little stuff like that, man. Like, I love it when an actor knows their character and they can do stuff like that. Like it all goes into him being him. We get a call back to to Austin punching a woman that is actually a man, although this time it is actually a woman, and it is Basil Exposition's mother. Whom he just punched dead in the nose,
and then proceeds to defend himself by saying, "If that is a woman, it looks like she's been beaten with an ugly stick." Damn it, man! That's my mother.
Then we get to one of the best scenes in the one of the funniest scenes in the movie. It is a therapy session with, is this Carrie Fisher?
It is Carrie Fisher, yes.
Yeah.
And actually, when she popped up, she wasn't doing much in the 90s up until this movie.
Yeah.
So it's kind of weird to see her there. It's like, it's hard to explain to you kids out there who are used to having Carrie Fisher in whatever Star Wars movie you want.
Yeah, but, for those of you who don't know Carrie Fisher, who Carrie Fisher is, that's Princess Leia. That's who Princess Leia is for reals. So her name isn't Princess Leia. It's Carrie Fisher.
I think the kids know that. They've seen episode 7 and 8.
Well, they know that now because they're like, who's this Carrie Fisher chick and why is she dead and why is it affecting my Star Wars movie? Oh, wait. It's because she's Princess Leia. So she's running a family therapy session for fathers and sons, and it is this whole scene is amazing. And Scott is complaining and he's like, he's trying to kill me, and everybody's like, oh, come on, he's not trying to kill you. And Dr. Evil's like, oh no, yes, I am trying to kill him.
The boy is quite astute.
He's wily like his old man, I'll give him that. And then we get into Dr. Evil's backstory. It's probably the funniest fucking
thing. Oh my god. Ever. Again, because it's played perfectly straight. My father used to accuse chestnuts of being lazy. the kind of thoughts that the, you know, that the geniuses, you know, malaise and insanities, you know, I can't even remember the fucking lines, but it's so good.
It's so funny.
Culminating in the ritual shaving of his scrotum when he was 14 years old.
Okay, well, we've heard from you, Scott. Now, you tell us a little about yourself.
The details of my life are quite inconsequential.
Oh, no, please, please. Let's hear about your childhood.
Yeah, okay. Come on, come on, come on, please. Very well. Where do I begin? My father was a relentlessly self-improving boulangerie owner from Belgium with low-grade narcolepsy and a penchant for buggery. My mother was a 15-year-old French prostitute named Chloe with webbed feet. My father would womanize, he would drink. He would make outrageous claims like he invented the question mark. Sometimes he would accuse chestnuts of being lazy, the sort of general malaise that only the genius possess and the insane lament. My childhood was typical. Summers in Rangoon, luge lessons. In the spring, we'd make meat helmets. When I was insolent, I was placed in a burlap bag and beaten with reeds. Pretty standard, really. At the age of 12, I received my first scribe. At the age of 14, a Zoroastrian named Vilma ritualistically shaved my testicles. There really is nothing like a shorn scrotum. It's breathtaking. I suggest you try it.
You know, we have to stop.
You might, and I suggest that you might enjoy it. And then Carrie Fisher's like, you know what? We got to stop. Sorry.
It's quite liberating.
Oh my God. Nothing like the feel of a shorn scraper.
Oh my God. It's fucking excellent. Like I said, the fact that he mentions that his mother was a web-toed prostitute named Chloe. Holy shit. Like I said, just a fantastic monologue.
Oh, my goodness gracious. We get a scene of Austin and Vanessa. And Vanessa's like, you know, hey, I appreciate you not taking advantage of me. And, you know, did you get everything you needed from a lot of vagina? And he was like, oh yeah, I shagged her rotten, baby, yeah. And she's just like, and Vanessa's like, wait, what? Like, yeah, I shagged her. It's just, you know, part of the job. Free love, baby. You know, she didn't mean anything. It was just sex. And she has to school him, like, look, this is the 90s, Jack. You know, you can't just go willy-nilly having sex with people. This isn't the free love, you know, hippie 60s thing anymore, man. You want to be with me, you gotta be a one-woman man.
So it's funny because they're obviously like poking fun at the old-fashioned nature of the fact that James Bond sleeps with 2 to 3 women a movie, basically. Mm-hmm. But it's just weird because it's coming on the heels of arguably the 3 most monogamous Bond movies. That they had, so like they had Living Daylights, where Bond basically slept with one person early in the film and then spent the rest of the film chasing Kara, right? And then License to Kill, he sleeps with Pam Bouvier. Does he sleep with Talisa Soto's character? I can't remember.
I can't remember
if he does or not. And then GoldenEye, he basically just sleeps with Natalia. Because he never actually gets to sleep with Xenia. He just, they come close a couple of times.
Yeah, they come close, but even James Bond was like, there's a good chance that I'm going to die.
So. Oh, I guess he also slept with the woman that was evaluating him at the beginning of the film as well. I think we're meant to assume that, so.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, because he had the champagne in the car, in the center compartment. So Austin goes and he does, research, because he's like, he really cares about Vanessa, and he does research and he tries to catch himself up, and he makes a list of people that he knows. And first on the list is Jimi Hendrix. And he's like, well, cross that out. He's dead due to drugs. And second is Janis Joplin. Oh, cross that out. Dead due to alcohol. And then the third on the list is Mama Cass. And it's like, oh, cross that out. Dead due to a ham sandwich. Jesus Christ, yo. this is something that dates the movie. He gets a pair of Reebok pumps.
But they were even out of style in 97.
Yeah, they were.
That was passé. I mean, I remember pumps being hot when I was, I think it was in third grade. So that would have been what year would that have been? That would have been like 92, I think.
Yeah, that's about right. I remember last time I had pumps, I was in Breckenridge, Colorado at a family reunion. And I remember my dad, there was a game that we had to play where it was a race. And my father was like, you better pump them shoes up. All that money I spent on them, they better work. I'm like, all right. Well, and I pumped the shoes up and I lost the race because I'm not athletically inclined.
God, how dumb were we as children to believe that a shoe that had an inflatable tongue could make you run faster and jump higher when properly inflated? We were so dumb. And I remember I couldn't afford Reebok pumps, so I had like the fake Fila versions that they had when they came out.
Oh man. Yeah, I remember that shit. And then he pumps the pump so much that, because he apparently gets a good feeling out of it, he pumps the pump so much that the pumps just burst, which isn't what would happen with pumps, but, it's a joke. He's sitting there with a bunch of tab, and he's watching, the moon landing and the Berlin Wall, like he's catching himself up. And Vanessa's like, look, I get that. I sometimes forget that you've been gone for 30 years, so you don't really know what's up.
What would that be like if you just, like, were in a coma for 30 years and then woke up? Can you imagine?
No, I cannot. I mean, it's not like in the 80s where we thought 30 years from now we'd be having flying cars and shit. Like, no, it's just a lifetime. Like, it's just half a lifetime. So I can't imagine. I mean, I can imagine it would be difficult for me to catch up a bit because I find it difficult for me now to do it.
Well, I mean, now is not really there's too much happening now. That's the problem.
Yeah. Like I've never been one to be a bigot, but at the same time, like, I feel like I might be because I don't understand what's going on in the world. You got fucking game show hosts running the country, and gay people aren't referring to themselves as gay anymore. Now it's LGBTQ. Like, what happened to gay? What happened to just being gay? I don't know, man. I'm old. Anyway, that was my old man rant. Sorry.
I'm just trying to think, if you were out for the same 30 years that he was out, I'm trying to think what the most important world events are. They touched on a couple. They touched on the moon landing and on the Berlin Wall coming down.
Like, what would have, like, if we had to educate someone
who was
out of it for 30 years and now they're back in 2018?
Yeah. I'm trying to think. So that would take us back to 88.
I mean, one, Donald Trump being the president would be a big fucking deal.
But that, like, they wouldn't even, I don't even, you know what? If they were out for 30 years, I don't think they would think it was that weird. Because, again, yeah, like, their last memory would be 80s douche Donald Trump.
Huh.
Like they wouldn't have had to see the decline. Right.
They skipped all of that. Yeah. So
they skipped all the apprentice and birtherism and Howard Stern and all that bullshit.
Yeah.
So maybe it wouldn't have been as weird if they'd been like, yeah, Donald Trump's president. They'd be like, okay, that makes sense, I guess.
Yeah. Isn't that why the Simpsons predicted it? Because it wouldn't necessarily be that weird.
Oh man, they would have no idea what the Simpsons is. If you
oh yeah, that's right. Ago. They literally would not have no idea, wouldn't have any idea what the Simpsons was.
God, so the end of the Cold War, because that would have been that predated that's 89. So, or the Berlin Wall coming down in 89.
Yeah, would have been a big deal. We had a black president. No, you didn't. Yeah, we did. No, you didn't.
But see, now Russia's going back to a, you know, back to a dictatorship society. So,
God damn, you know what that means? We've regressed.
Right, so time is a flat circle, Micah. So, just the invention of the internet would be probably the most mind blowing thing for anybody that's been in a coma for the last 30 years.
Yeah, yeah,
and the medium, and just how media is delivered as well. Because again, back in the '80s, it's cassettes and VHS.
Yeah, is what you had. Literally have music beamed to your phone. Like, oh yeah, and by the way, everybody has one now, and they're not gigantic.
Right, they fit in your pocket, and they're more powerful than, you know, a $5,000 computer would have been in 1988. They made more Star Wars. Oh, great. you might want to stay in the coma for that one.
Remember in 1985 when you were playing Mario? Well, look at this.
Yeah, could you imagine?
And then you show them the trailer for The Last of Us 2, and it's just like, what the fuck?
That would be interesting. That would be interesting.
I would hate to have to do it, though. I don't have the patience.
Well, and also 9/11 would also be kind of a huge deal.
Yeah. Yeah, because they wouldn't believe it. Like, America got what? America?
It still blows my mind that there are people that are graduating high school that weren't born when 9/11 happened.
Jesus Christ. We're old, man.
We are super old.
So Austin and Vanessa are infiltrating Virchicon. In the most ridiculous disguises.
I'm not even sure what Austin Powers is supposed to be dressed like. Like Vanessa's dressed as like the stereotypical, you know, American female tourist from the South that loves the fucking USA,
yeah,
wearing like the fucking Star Spangled Banner cowboy hat and all this other bullshit.
Austin is dressed like a prototypical version of his character from The Love Guru.
Oh, okay.
And it is where in that movie, Mike Myers played an Indian fellow, a guy from India. No, don't do that. and the dude from, Modern Family is there giving, or no, that's the,
that's the wig master.
Yeah. That's the wig master. I get all redheads confused. That dude looked like Andy to me, because I get all my heads confused.
Again, great sight gag is they see two employees leave this restricted area and go into several bathrooms. A very short and squat fat woman and a very tall and slender man, and they go into the bathrooms and I guess beat them up and take their clothes, but the clothes are tailored perfectly, of course, and they walk out despite the fact that that wouldn't make any sense.
So the wig master informs people that they have infiltrated, and At one point, Austin and Vanessa hijack a steamroller.
Well, it's the steamroller testing facility. Every great corporation has one.
And we get a cool little, we get a funny little gag of a security guard played by Michael McDonald, of Mad TV fame. And he is in the path of this steamroller barreling down at 5 miles an hour. And they're like, get out of the way, get out of the way. And he's just petrified with fear. He's like, no. And the camera zooms in on his face as if, you know, it's a high speed thing, like about to hit him. And it's like, no. And then he doesn't move and he gets squished.
Like I said, because they keep cutting back and forth between him, like close up terror, and then the wide shot that shows the steamroller is like 20 feet away from him still. Very good.
Random task ends up knocking out our two heroes, and he takes them to the I guess this is the nuclear missile testing facility.
Yes.
Where
they're served dinner by Dr. Evil, as is customary in these films.
Scott, I want you to meet Daddy's nemesis, Austin Powers.
What are you feeding him? Why don't you just kill him?
No, Scott, I have an even better idea. I'm going to place him in an easily escapable situation involving an overly elaborate and exotic death.
Why don't you just shoot him now? I mean, I'll go get a gun. We'll shoot him together. It'll be fun. Bang! Dead. Done.
One more peep out of you and you are grounded, mister, and I am not joking. All right, let's begin.
I didn't notice until I watched it this time that there is a sliced brain that is being served at the table,
shit,
right in front of Dr.
Right
Evil. And they went with the anatomically correct color as well, instead of the normal pink brain that you see in most films.
So Scott comes out, right? And this is another one of those obvious things that's obvious, but it's funny because we all know it's obvious, but we never see someone point it out in a film. And Scott comes out and he's like, who are these people? And he's like, this is my nemesis, Austin Powers. And he's like, what are you feeding him for? Why don't you just kill him? He's like, no, we don't do that. Look, I mean, but he's right there. Like, we could just kill him and be done with it right there. It's like, but no, you don't understand. That's not how things are done. And Scott's like, I got a gun in my room right now. I can go get it. It's 2 seconds. I can go get it. We can pop a cap in these dudes and we're done. And it's just like, no, that's not how we do it. And then he keeps protesting. And then Dr. Evil's like, shh.
I love, because he even goes as far as like, he's like, what? I'm going to put them into an easily escapable situation with a highly elaborate death. What?
And then
I get it, even like the chain, like close the chamber, like the chamber doors close. And he's like, you're not even going to watch. He's like, no, I'm just going to assume everything went to plan.
Every time Scott tries to say something, Dr. Evil just shushes him. And it goes on back and forth. And it's really fun. And that was improvised.
It's hard to it's hard to understate to someone who wasn't an adolescent in 1997 the cultural impact that this movie actually had on pop culture. So it's funny because you think that this movie was super popular. It actually really wasn't. It didn't do that well. It did okay. Like it made plenty of money, but it was like only like the 40th ranked film that came out that year, if you believe it, in terms of box office.
I think the second one was the one that really hit.
Second one was the one that really hit. Well, because the first one also had a long shelf life, like, you know, with like movie sales and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I can't think of the last movie. I'm sure there's been movies that I'm just spacing on, but like this is the last movie that I distinctly remember that had a huge like cultural impact on the zeitgeist, especially with kids that were our age, because yeah, baby, and all the gags from the film became part of like your vernacular, basically.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah. My wife still uses the term mini-me when referring to, you know, children who look exactly like their parents. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, that's more of the second one, which goes to show you that the second one was more popular than the first one, because she don't remember this, right? But she remembers bits of the second one. So yeah, they get put in an easily escapable situation.
Well, so again, he wanted sharks with freaking laser beams attached to their heads, but apparently, even though Virtucon makes $9 billion a year, there had to be budget cuts, and so he had to get they can only afford sea bass, and like Dr. Evil's beside himself. And number two is like, well, they are mutated. He's like, well, that's a good start. Are they ill-tempered? Very.
Oh, good.
So a bunch of ill-tempered mutated sea bass.
That apparently are, they get the job done, because they are, Austin and Vanessa are put in a pit over the mutated sea bass, and Austin uses dental floss to swing to safety.
Right. Meanwhile, like the guards, the one guard that's stationed inside of the chamber is watching all of this unfold pretty much.
Yeah. And the guy's got a gun. Like, why don't you just shoot him? And Austin gets the upper hand and pushes the guard's head into the water where the ill-tempered sea bass are. And he pulls it out and the head is just gone. Like, those sea bass were not fucking around.
And then they drag the one-liner quip into the ground, basically, because he rolls off like four basically in a row. Not a good time to lose one's head.
I do that actually more often than I probably should.
where you just beat the pun into the ground, basically.
Just beat a joke into the ground or over explain the joke for comedic effect. Especially if a joke that I say bombs, then I will over explain it to try and elicit a laugh or just, all right, we get it. Because I would, much like wrestling, rather get a bad reaction than no reaction whatsoever. So Austin and Vanessa split up to look for Dr. Evil. And at one point, Austin is confronted by all of the fembots. And they basically start attacking, and in like a sexual way, in a very sexiful way, and Austin eventually gets the upper hand, because even those fembots are no match for Austin's animal magnetism.
I think my favorite part of that whole dance sequence, basically, where he's dancing around in his briefs to make the headbot's head explode, is when he like he whips out the seven cigarettes simultaneously and then lights them all with a blowtorch and just starts flicking them into their mouths, basically, from around the room. It's very good.
Oh man.
Do you think James Bond wears England underwear?
I think Roger Moore James Bond does.
That probably makes the most sense. Honestly. Yeah. So if you were gonna target one that would wear England briefs, it would probably be Roger Moore.
So yeah, he's doing his dance, and Vanessa comes in and catches him, and he's just like, oh, it's not what it seems, baby. No, you know, at ease, gentlemen. And she's just like, all right, I believe you, whatever. Then we see this very phallic looking drill being loaded with a nuclear warhead, and Dr. Evil is seen.
Dr. No, so
right. and he's drilling it into the ground, and we get a big shootout, and once again Austin is firing his gun, and every time the trigger is pulled he closes his eyes.
By the way, we missed the Goldfinger line earlier too, because when they're at dinner, because he was like, "Do you expect them to pay?" He's like, "No, Mr. Powers, I expect them to die."
This shit just made no sense. Austin, they hit abort. They hit the big button to stop the drill, and hooray.
I gotta tell you, so this little action sequence here inside of the operations chamber, I swear to God that they were using just exact shots from You Only Live Twice in this. because you see dudes flying all over the place on the mini trampolines, which they abused to death in that film. And like the scene where like the five like Dr. Evil guards like get up on top of this thing. Like, I swear to God that exact shot is in the volcano lair attack scene in You Only Live Twice. I swear that it is.
Oh, shit. So Austin confronts Dr. Evil, but a lot of vagina comes in, and she has Vanessa hostage. And they are interrupted by number two, because number two is like, yo, I've had enough of this. So a lot of vagina comes in with Kensington, and Austin grabs Scott, and number two comes in with a briefcase that has a fembot in it, folded up, but you could see like the hair and the boots sticking out on the sides of it, because he's gonna go have a good time with that fembot, and he's there to betray Dr. Evil, because it's like, yo, you're dumb, yo. Like, our legitimate business is a multi-billion-dollar corporation, and you over here worried about some goddamn taking over the world bullshit? Like, nah, man. And where am I? Dr. Evil uses a trap door to eliminate number two, because number two sits down in one of the chairs. And so Dr. Evil kills number two, and he hits the self-destruct button, and he escapes in his egg, in his cryogenically frozen egg thing. And Austin and Vanessa, they flee, and they get into the Union Jack Roadster, and they take off, and we get stock footage. Like, very blatant stock footage of some sort of sand dune being blown up. And then we cut to 3 months later. 3 months later, Austin is married to Vanessa, and they're on their honeymoon. And, you know, much like classic James Bond films, just because the main villain is gone, that doesn't mean the danger is over. And they are attacked by random task. But Austin uses the penis pump to subdue random task.
I do also love that. So random task gets the drop on them, and he throws his shoe, and it's Austin in the head. But rather than break his neck, as you'd expect it to do, it just really hurts. That's all.
Yeah.
He's just like, wow. It's like, who throws a shoe? Honestly, you fight like a woman.
Oh shit. But yeah, they subdue him, and then they go out and look at the stars, and we cut one last shot of Dr. Evil inside his cryogenically frozen thing, but he's not fully frozen yet.
Yeah.
And he's just like, I'll get you, Austin Powers, and there you go.
And that was Austin Powers.
That's Austin Powers, man.
Like I said, I really enjoyed this, but I hadn't seen it in a couple of years, and I really did enjoy it. It's just, like I said, the first one is so pure, and the reason that the other ones aren't as good is because it's just more of this, and they just either copy gags from the first films or they just make them bigger. So like Mike Myers obviously is playing two characters in this one. Well, in the next one, he plays three. And in the one after that, he plays four.
Goldmember is really bad.
Goldmember is really bad.
Like, I really don't like Goldmember.
Because it's not a good movie.
No, it's not a good movie. I remember bits and pieces of the Spy Who Shagged Me, and I remember enjoying it, but yeah, I like the first two. The third one is just not good at all.
No, it really is not. So let me ask you this question. Do you think that Austin Powers had any tangible impact on the Bond franchise? Because I'm trying to think of the Bond movies that immediately followed it. So by the time this came out, Tomorrow Never Dies was already in production, so couldn't really have too much impact there. So World Is Not Enough and Die Another Day were the next two that came after this. And I'm just trying to think if there's any, if I can point to any tangible meaning that the Austin Powers films had for the Bond franchise. And I'm really struggling to think of anything.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think the Bond films really were influenced by any other films up until Casino Royale. When did that first Bourne movie come out? Casino Royale came out in 06.
Bourne was 02, I think the first one was. That's not true, though. I mean, License to Kill definitely was inspired by late 80s action movies. Like that was the one anomaly in all the Bond films.
It really feels different from every other James Bond movie.
And by different, you mean it feels the same as every other 80s action movie that came out around that time period, from the score to the way the action is shot to, you know, what they're dealing with and being a drug dealer and stuff like that. I can't think of anything. And I think the reason why I don't think it had too much of an impact is because, like I said, this was, you know, specifically hitting the Connery era Bond films. Like that was the one. I mean, for fuck's sake, they go to Vegas and, you know, the gags that you see are mostly from You Only Live Twice and Thunderball and Dr. No and Goldfinger and stuff like that. So, I don't think too much that the Wilsons were paying too much attention to, or the Broccolis, I should say, were paying too much attention to what this film was doing. But like I said, for someone that is a Bond fan that gets all of the jokes and references and stuff like that, this was a delight. And my appreciation for this film has only grown over time, because of course, when I first saw it, I wasn't quite, you know, neck deep into the James Bond cinematic universe at that point. But since I am now, when I go back, I can catch all the very little overt Bond references in this film. So.
Wow, wow. I'm looking at some of the information from Goldmember. I'm just like, ooh, this was not a
good movie. And the biggest issue that I have with Goldmember is that's when they started to parody themselves in that movie. I mean, shit, Goldmember ends with, you know, the premiere of the Austin Powers movie starring Tom Cruise and Kevin Spacey and all these other known actors, and basically. And Austin Powers and Dr. Evil are brothers, come to find out.
Yeah.
Separated.
Yeah. There you go.
Michael
Caine. There you go. That's what happened. The people that did Spectre remembered Goldmember. It was like, oh, shit, fucking Dr. Evil and our Blofeld clone and our James Bond clone are brothers. Let's just do that.
Yeah, I think we pointed that out during our Spectre review. I think somebody pointed that out during the Spectre review that it was making fun of Goldmember, which is not the movie that you want to be making fun of, for sure.
You don't want to take your cues from a spoof movie if your movie is not a spoof, especially if the spoof that they're spoofing you.
Yes, what you said. Exactly correct. But yeah, man, like I said, I love the first Austin Powers. I think it's a delightful film. And again, I think it's smart. I think the jokes for the most part land very well. I think it holds up with the occasional, you know, dated 90s reference here and there.
Yeah.
And like I said, I find it more enjoyable than the other two films. I mean, maybe we'll get to Spy Shaggy. I know we're not going to do fucking Goldmember, because
no,
neither of us want to watch that movie again, I don't think.
for you numbers people, the spy who are international man of mystery costs $16.5 million and made $67.7 million.
God, can you imagine a movie of this caliber only costing $16 million today?
Not at all. The Spy Who Shagged Me, the sequel, cost $33 million to make and made a whopping $312 million at the box office. Gold Member cost $63 million to make and made $296.7 million.
Oh, good. Well, at least the audience is wised up.
Yeah.
After the second one, so.
Yeah.
But yeah, Mike Myers, like I said, you did a good job, buddy. And also weirdly, like a weird thing in the 90s was actors playing multiple characters in the same movie.
Yeah.
Was a trend. Like Nutty Professor started this weird trend where there were a couple of movies where actors would play multiple roles in heavy prosthesis.
I don't mind it if you are a good impressionist. Like if your voices are different enough, Eddie Murphy could get away with it because he did a better job in the early 90s, but he could get away with it because usually his voices were different enough. All of Mike Myers' voices sound the same to me. they just do. Like who was Fat Bastard? Like like they you're not even trying at this point.
No, they like yeah, they I Fat mean Dr. Evil's pretty on the nose as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, Fat Bastard sounds like Shrek. Dr. Evil sounds like he just sounds like every other Mike Myers character. Webbed feet.
I do also appreciate during the counseling scene, Mr. Evil, Dr. Evil. I did not go to 7 years of evil medical school to be called Mr. Evil. Thank you very much.
Oh shit!
We all know it. We all know a person with a doctorate who.
Let me tell you something. They're all like that. It just depends on the type of person. Whether they all want to be called doctor, right? They all do, but only the dickheads point it out.
But yeah, like I said, if you're a movie, I think if you're a movie fan too, this movie is really good just because of all the different notable actors that pop up throughout this film.
Yeah, and they really pop up in the later.
Oh yeah, no, like, well, because then everyone wanted to get on the bandwagon, you know.
Everybody wanted to get on the Austin train. But I look, if you can find this movie, rent it. It's cheap to rent. If you're a youngin, you can find a bunch of things that you can look up. You can look up what the hell Bob's Big Boy was and then tell us whether or not you have one near you. Any closing remarks?
Just that this is really good and eventually we're going to be doing the 67 Casino Royale. And that is not really good.
That probably won't be the next one.
No, it won't be the next one. Like I said, next one we're going to go back to whatever James Bond topic we planned on doing first before schedules got hinky for a month, and then we just need to throw this one together quick. So we're going to go. I don't remember what that was. I'm going to go back and listen to the Never Say Never Again episode to remember what topic we're going to do in the next episode. But if we're going to be soliciting the fans, the listeners' input on that topic, we will let you know in the fan group, which is thenerdpocalypse.com/fans, which excellent. All of which I think anyone listening to this probably is already in, I would imagine. Yes,
I would assume.
But one would assume. I don't think anyone wandered into premium content just off the street and doesn't, you know, talk to us on a regular basis. So. And thank you, by the way, for subscribing, those of you that are listening to this.
Yes, thank you very much. You can listen to all of our premium content. Look Forward has been firing on all cylinders.
So it has.
Lately. So even if you are, a casual person who pays attention to politics like I am, you will get a lot out of that show.
And then, of course, airing grievances. You guys are right in the midst of the salad days of Seinfeld right now. I think you're in season.
Yeah, we are. I think we're like halfway through season six.
Holy shit. You guys are really moving along.
Yeah, we are making a concerted effort to try and get these things out on a regular basis.
You guys are very quickly approaching the episodes that transcend the reality, basically.
Yeah, the ones that just when Seinfeld gets like really like wacky. Like at one point Newman is picturing Kramer as a turkey. Like it's some of them get weird and they get even more, you know, brutal. And we'll have a bunch of stories like that for you.
I can't. So the chest shaving episode was on last night, and I'm looking forward to whatever that episode comes around. just to hear if there's any ridiculous stories around that, and also what the Micah and Jay reality tour would look like.
Oh man, yeah.
And then No Time to Bleed. I don't know if we have one in the chamber right now, but that's probably coming up
soon.
We
will have one by the time this comes out. Yeah, we picked the movie, and Terrence picked it. So who knows?
Oh, you don't even know what it is yet.
I think he finally decided on something. I think he decided on The Last Boy Scout.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah,
I think that's a really good one. Boy Scout. So, actually,
look forward to that. Yes, thank you very much. The Men with the Golden Tongues will return next month with something.
A list.
Everyone loves lists.
We do.
So we'll see you.
See you.